It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Our next guest is a mother of two. When she found out her second child was going to be a boy, she thought she'd never get to teach her kid how to braid hair or play with Barbies.
But the little boy she gave birth to didn't turn out to be the sports-playing type after all. Lori Duran is the creator of the first mommy blog to focus on raising a gender-creative child, and the author of the new book, Raising My Rainbow, Adventures in Raising a Fabulous Gender Creative Son. Lori, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you talk about raising your son, CJ, as a BB and AB, before Barbie and after Barbie. Can you tell us what happened that day?
Yes, his life is marked in time by before Barbie and after Barbie. So before Barbie, he was born up until the time he was 2 and a half, and he would get the hand-me-downs from his brother Chase, and they would be trains and trucks and cars and balls and action figures that he just wasn't interested in. He was a happy child, but just nothing seemed to grab his attention. And then there was a day when he found a Barbie that had been in my closet, and sometimes we say that's the day he came alive. And from that point on, it's been after Barbie, and he says that's the day he knew that he liked girl stuff.
What was his reaction like when he found that Barbie buried in your closet?
He saw it, so I was cleaning out my closet, and I actually grabbed it and threw it onto my bed. It was in a box. It was a boxed 50th anniversary Barbie. And he came into my room, and he saw it, and his eyes just lit up, and he grabbed it off the bed and started jumping up and down. He said, "What, Dad? What, Dad?" Because he was 2 and a half. He wanted to know what it was, and when I said, "It's a Barbie," he said, "I want to open she." And, like, he just couldn't, he was not going to take no for an answer, so... At first, I was hesitant to open it because, as anyone knows, you don't open a box to Barbie because they depreciate in value. And I thought he's going to play with it for a day or two and then get bored of it, but he didn't. That's the day he really did start liking girl stuff.
And what was your reaction? What was going through your head when you realized that he wasn't just taking a shine to this Barbie? I mean, this was going to be a swerve in his life.
Well, there were lots of conversations. The first day or two, it felt a little uncomfortable seeing him play with a doll, but it also reminded me of my brother who had played with Barbies as a child with me. And I thought, oh, it's just a short phase, but it wasn't. And there were lots of conversations that CJ's dad and I had late at night in our room trying to figure out what it meant. I think as parents, we're always trying to figure out our kids and what does it mean and what do I need to do next and what do I need to do as a parent. But when that happens and when your child starts to show signs of gender nonconformity and possibly being transgender, there are no answers. So it's scary.
So did you have to navigate those waters on your own, or did you seek professional help at a certain point?
Initially, it was on our own, and then talking to my brother, who, like I said, now we know he was gender nonconforming at heart as a child, and he now identifies as gay. But it was talking to him because our parents weren't great about it and weren't supportive of his gender nonconformity. So it was talking to him and then talking to each other, but I couldn't find any experts or resources, and I think like any mom in my generation, I went online to find answers and mommy blogs or parenting websites that address the issue of boys playing with girl things or wanting to wear girl clothes, and I couldn't find anything, and so that's when I started my blog, raisingmyrainbow.com.
So you talk about how in the beginning you tried to draw lots of lines in the sand, saying, okay, you can play with all this pink girly stuff, but it has to be only at home. And then, you can do it in the car too, but it can't be outside the car. What was that process like as you sort of opened the door to let the world see what your son really was and let him be himself? How did that process go?
Yeah, I felt like I was trying to protect him, or like we were trying to protect him. So we did have those lines of you can play with the girl toys and wear the girl clothes at the house, but not out of the house. And then you can do it in the car, but not out of the car. And then you could do it at this destination, but not that destination. And it was confusing him and it was confusing us because we had drawn these lines, but then we'd erase them and move them or move them back or move them forward. And so it was really confusing and we weren't parenting consistently with him. And then we also got to the point where we realized our older son, Chase, was allowed to bring his action figures and his Legos anywhere he wanted. There weren't these restrictions. So we realized that we were really parenting unfairly and that we were also drawing those lines because we were worried about what other people would think or say, and we realized we can't parent based on what other people, what their reaction's going to be. We have to parent based on what's best for our son.
So your worst fears, when your mom kind of asked you, what are you so afraid of? And you just sort of blurted out what other people think. You were thinking the worst, that your son was going to get bullied, that people were going to judge you and your family. What happened? Did that come to pass, those fears?
Sometimes, but I had to get to the point where I realized that that was my biggest fear. And then I was so disappointed in myself because that's not the kind of person or mother that I want to be, you know, constantly afraid of what other people are going to think or what they're going to say. So I had to be a woman. I had to be an adult and realize that it didn't matter what they said. What mattered was my son's safety. And the statistics for boys like CJ aren't great as far as their safety and their adulthood go. So I needed to make sure that I focused on him and not others' reactions.
What do you mean by safety? What are the things that can happen to transgender kids?
Kids who are in the LGBTQ community, so that's lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community, they have the, and especially those who are gender nonconforming or transgender, have the highest rate of attempted suicide in the world. They are much more likely to experience or suffer from major depression, substance abuse, unsafe sexual behaviors as adults. And then nearly all of them report being bullied or teased at school, and a lot of them report being bullied and teased at home as well. So it's kind of a bleak future if you don't support these kids and get them the help and give them the unconditional love that they deserve.
Now, you're credited with having the first blog like this, the first blog about raising a non-gender conforming child that's been out there. What is the response been as you put your family out there for everyone to know and to learn from?
Well, I was really careful, too, when I started. So on my blog, I've never shown a picture of our faces. I just showed a picture of my face with the release of my book, but I haven't shown the kids' faces, and I'm careful about what I write about. I really wanted it to be for parents. So it's from the viewpoint of me as a parent and my adventures in raising him. It's not some of his personal private struggles. They're definitely issues that are his that I haven't written about on the blog, but it was scary. It was scary because I felt so alone. That's part of the reason why I started the blog. And so I put it out there hoping people would find me, but then there was this lingering, what if I really am alone? What if there is no one else out there? But I quickly found that there were other families like ours, and they had been looking for the resources that I had been looking for. And so I slowly, over the course of 3 years, I've had over a million viewers and in 173 countries. And that's something that surprised me, too, is that this is a global parenting issue.
And so have you created kind of a network, a community of parents who are raising kids the way you are?
Yeah, I do. I have a network, and I have parents that I talk to who are in France and Ireland and Iran, the Philippines, all over. And then we also, which is really great, is we started a gender nonconforming play group in our area. So about once a month we get together, and there's a handful of us families that have gender nonconforming sons, and we get together and they get to do exactly what they want to do and be who they're created to be. And then sometimes the siblings come along, and sometimes the moms and the dads, we get together and it's a big family ordeal, but it's fun for all those kids to get together, and that's been one of the best parts.
It seems as though we're on sort of a new frontier when it comes to accepting different forms of gender in our society. And that, NPR recently ran a story about how it's pretty common practice in a lot of college classrooms now for students to go around, say their name, and say what gender pronouns they want to be identified with. And so there's I don't know, it seems like there's this burgeoning awareness of what is going on there in terms of gender. Do you feel that as well?
I do feel it. And I feel, just because stories like ours and are getting attention and are getting even published or put out there, I feel like people are starting to see it, and maybe they're a little bit more willing to see it. And to me, like that, the example that you gave about pronouns isn't even so much a gender issue. It's an empathy issue, and it's treating people like people and treating them how they want to be treated. So, I mean, that's our big thing, is that you don't have to understand gender, sex, and sexuality and the distinct differences between all of them. But if you could just have empathy and an open heart and open mind, that's all we ask for. And I think that's all anyone asks for, no matter their gender or sex or sexuality.
We're talking right now with Lori Duran, author of Raising My Rainbow, Adventures in Raising a Fabulous Gender Creative Son. She blogs at raisingmyrainbow.com.
How about you now? Are you the parents or grandparents of what we're talking about, a gender creative child? Do you need advice? Do you think, you see a kid playing with a doll and you think, ooh, that's a problem, or that's no big deal? Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. We're talking now with Lori Duran, author of the first mommy blog to chronicle the life of a gender-creative child. And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have? Are you going through an experience similar to Lori's with a child who doesn't conform to a particular gender? And what challenges have you faced? Or if you've come across children like this out and about, what do you think? And how do you think, what do you think of Lori's example of how she's handling it? Our number, 1-800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Lori, early on, you tell a story about one of your first Christmases after Barbie, where your son CJ demonstrates this huge, you know, affinity for Barbies and pink things. And you're trying to navigate those waters at Christmas time, trying to decide what to get him that'll make him happy, but that, you know, won't be too out there. Can you tell us that story about that Christmas?
Yeah, it was Christmas time, and it had been a couple months since we'd noticed CJ's gender nonconformity, although at that point we didn't know what to call it. We just knew that he liked girl stuff. And so it was Christmas, and so I bought him a baby doll, but it was a blue boy baby doll, and I got him a stroller because I knew he'd love the stroller to push it around, but I got him a blue stroller, and then we got him a car for his Barbies, but it was white, and it had some decals, some pink decals and flowers that we could have put on it, but we left them off. So I felt like I was getting him girl stuff in a way, but it was boy stuff in a way, and I thought it was playing it safe because, you know, a lot of people will tell me, well, if you take all the girl stuff away, he'll play with the boy stuff, and he'll like the boy stuff. So that was me trying to play it safe, or I don't know what, but he just wasn't as excited. He hung on to that original Barbie that he had found. He opened it all up, and he would push things around in the stroller, but, you know, it wasn't exactly what he wanted. And, of course, his brother got everything that he wanted, or pretty much all of the main things, and he got his Legos and everything else and remote control cars, and he was ecstatic, but CJ was left a little bit underwhelmed, and my husband said to me, you know, we're not going to do that again next year. If he still likes girl stuff, we're going to get him girl stuff. But that was part of our evolution and part of us not fully accepting it or being comfortable with his gender nonconformity.
And you come to the point where you have really strong feelings about this, and you're providing that support network for your child that maybe your brother didn't have growing up. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your feelings about Dr. Phil, who has had people ask him, you know, what do I do if my child, my son likes girl stuff? And you don't like his answer.
Yeah, he says to redirect and to take the girl toys away and only provide boy toys and redirect them and redirect their attention towards masculine things. And it's sad. It's sad to me. I've never met Dr. Phil, but his answers that he provides are sad because I feel like they can do a lot of harm to the children and to the parents. And I think that he has a lot of power to do a lot of good. And so I wish that his answer would be different and that he wouldn't ask to redirect. There's been studies done on trying to redirect and do reparative therapy to kids and to adults who are like CJ. And it's been really, really dangerous. Even studies that have been deemed a success. One of the biggest ones that came out of UCLA, the boy eventually died from suicide and it wasn't his first attempt. So, you know, it makes me sad.
Okay, I want to go to the phones right now. And don't forget, you can join this conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Let's go to Maureen in Oshkosh. Hi, Maureen.
Hi. I have a couple comments. I certainly support that children should not be forced into gender binaries, but it occurs to me that some of what your guest is talking about seems to reinforce gender binaries. I mean, we have every single toy in our society which is gendered now. We can't even get a green bike. We have to get a pink slumber party bike or a black assault attack bike. Why can't we just have dolls and toys and green bikes and blue bikes and red bikes and not, you know, we have gendered toothpaste now for children. So I feel like, you know, that's part of the problem. And in some ways, going the sparkle glitter route is reinforcing gender binaries. That's my first point. My second point is, isn't some of this sexualizing children before they are actually sexual beings? So to talk about a gay, lesbian, or transgender four-year-old, or even a straight four-year-old, seems to me to be imposing adult categories on children. So I look forward to your response.
Okay, thank you, Maureen. And what do you think, Lori?
I think in a way she's right. I mean, not even in a way, but when it comes to the toy section, there are pink aisles and there are blue aisles. And so we had never even ventured into the pink aisles with our sons before because we had boys. And so you go to the blue aisles and there are toy stores over in Europe that they separate by the kind of toy, you know, like all dolls or all circus theme. It's not pink and it's not blue. Why can't the toy aisles all be yellow and then kids could find what they like amongst the gender neutral colors? So I totally agree. And I wish that there were more choices for CJ that were more or considered to be gender neutral or gender neutral in color. So I totally agree with that. As far as am I imposing some sort of other gender stereotype on him? No, I'm letting him choose what he likes to play with. He's 6 and a half, so I let him do that now. And it happens to be things that would be considered more fabulous and sparkly. That's what he's drawn to. So he's 6 and a half, so I let him choose his own toys. And then the sexualizing, I've never claimed a sexuality for my son. He's 6. He doesn't have one, or at least he doesn't have one that he's told me about so far. So why do I group him in with the LGBTQ community is because we have considered that he's transgender or that he's Q. He's questioning his gender. So that's why we group him in there, and also because that community has been so great and has had such a wealth of knowledge for us.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the call, Maureen. And we go next to Reggie in Milwaukee. Hi, Reggie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I called in because I'm an out gay man, and I'm the pursuits that I have pursued in my life. And sorry, there's some dogs barking in the background. But the things that I pursued in my life have been things that people might perceive as being strictly masculine endeavors. But they, for me, as a child, they were always framed in a feminine kind of way. So I was really into the female warrior as a child. I grew up watching Linda Carter as Wonder Woman. I wanted the Wonder Woman doll, but wasn't allowed to get it. Mm. But at the same time, I excelled in sports and athleticism, but it was always framed in a way where, like, a typical guy might say, I'm a warrior. Well, I'll tell you, I'm an Amazon. And the thing with that, though, is that from the outside and on the surface, it might look like those are typical masculine endeavors, but it's always been framed in a way that has been referential to the female warrior. I'm in criminal justice law enforcement to be a cop, and I'll tell you all day I represent the Amazon. And a child that's into feminine toys and the matter may not necessarily be transgender, but might be a gay man or a gay woman, a lesbian, but at the same time, they may also be transgender.
Right.
And I think, though, I maybe possibly had it a little easy because of the fact that I so identified with the female warrior. And in our society, people, when it comes to men, really respect that sort of aggressiveness and athleticism. And that's just kind of my 2 cents on the matter.
All right, Reggie, thank you so much. What an interesting call. And, you know, he's talking about how he liked some pursuits that were traditional, but they were framed differently. They were framed from, you know, the Amazon perspective as a female warrior. What do you think about that, Lori?
I love his perspective and I love his strength. My brother, too, wanted a Wonder Woman doll, but was not allowed to have one as a child. So I identify with that. And then my husband is a police officer, so I identify with that as well. And I think that sense of strength and confidence is what I hope to instill in CJ so that no matter what he has to face going forward, he's just a really strong, confident person as an adult.
Okay, I think we may have time for one more quick call. Jenny in Williams Bay, you're next. Hi.
Hi, I just wanted to say she's calling toys already girl toys or boy toys. You don't have to really call toys girl or boy to your kid. Just call it a toy. My 5-year-old likes pink things too, and we don't really call them girl toys. We get a lot of Melissa and Doug toys, I guess, where they're like neutral. We don't go in the toy aisle a lot, like at Target, because it is so segregated. So as long as you don't call them girl or boy toys, you know, early on, I think they understand more.
Right.
You know,
all right.
All
well, thank you so much for the call, Jenny. Appreciate that. And Melissa and Doug toys, I think, are for a younger demographic than your child, CJ. What do you think, Lori?
Yeah, and I just want to be absolutely clear. Like in our house, colors are for everyone. Toys are for everyone. We don't say things are girl toys or boy toys, but I do in conversations like this. So, because if I just said toys, sometimes it's confusing to people or they don't quite understand or they can't paint that picture in their head of my son playing with girl toys. But in our house, everything is to be enjoyed by everyone.
Well, Lori, it's been great. Thank you so much for talking today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
That was Lori Duran, author of Raising My Rainbow, Adventures in Raising a Fabulous Gender Creative Son. She blogs at raisingmyrainbow.com.
Coming up after the news, a look at today's G20 summit, conflict there between leaders of the United States and elsewhere over Syria.
And we profile Dukes of Hazzard star Tom Wopat in the latest installment of our Wisconsin Legends series. This is Central Time, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned, there's more to come. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll continue our Wisconsin Legends series. We'll talk to actor and singer Tom Wopat.
First, though, the 2013 G20 Leader Summit began today in St. Petersburg, Russia.
Leaders from the world's wealthiest countries have gathered for a two-day meeting that, until about a week ago, was supposed to focus on economic growth and trade relations.
However, it looks like this year, the debate over military action in Syria might be overshadowing economic issues, and as the Syria issue has strained an already tense relationship between the U.S. and Russia, eyes are on President Obama and Vladimir Putin to see how that tension plays out.
Josh Gerstein joins us now. He's senior White House reporter at Politico. Josh, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be with you.
So timing here for this G20 summit, bit awkward for President Obama, given all the Syria international debate going on. What does he have to worry about going into this conference?
Well, I mean, the main concern is that he's on Vladimir Putin, Russian President Vladimir Putin's home turf, that Putin has to some extent control over the agenda and particularly the mechanics of, what's going to take place in front of the cameras and behind the cameras. And so it's just very awkward since Putin has been the main thorn in the side of the U.S. in trying to take some action in the Syria crisis.
This is, as I mentioned, supposed to be an economic summit. I assume that people are still going to be meeting on the economy. Is anybody really focusing on that in the coverage you're seeing on this?
Well, in the coverage, no, although there are, of course, financial news outlets that are always focused on the minutiae of any currency moves, trade moves, or things of that sort. But it was said explicitly by Putin at the first session earlier today that they would, at a working dinner the leaders are having this evening, talk about the issue of Syria and, formally put that on the agenda. Up till that point, it wasn't clear if it would just be an issue talked about in the hallways or actually part of the formal meeting.
Is that something that President Obama wants to see happen?
You know, it's unclear. The White House said that they weren't among the countries that asked that it be added to the formal agenda. I think the White House knew that it was inevitable that there would be some discussion of the subject, but my impression going into the meeting was that the U.S. was hoping to keep it as much as possible to the economic issues because of their concern that if it really turned to Syria in a substantial way, Russia would be there to object to whatever the U.S. was saying. And the truth is that the lineup of countries there is not particularly aligned with the U.S., at least on the question of whether there should be a military response to the use of chemical weapons in Syria.
So after some back and forth, is President Obama going to end up meeting with President Putin at any point, one-on-one?
I think it's likely that they'll have conversations. The White House has been pretty clear that there's no intention to have any type of formal meeting. They have announced formal meetings with the Japanese Prime Minister, the German Chancellor, and the Chinese President. But Putin is being, notably omitted from that list, and people are probably aware that there was supposed to be, prior to this summit, a meeting between Obama and Putin in Moscow, and President Obama canceled that a month or so ago, partially over the Edward Snowden leaks matter, but generally over a lack of progress and a lack of seeing eye to eye in the U.S.-Russia relationship.
Human rights in Russia have been a concern. Is President Obama going to try to cast a light on that at all?
Well, he will, and, you know, maybe a little bit of a pushback towards Putin trying to stir up trouble on the Syria issue. The president is set meetings tomorrow on Friday. I think one meeting basically with what they call civil society representatives, largely human rights activists, including a couple of activists from Russia's lesbian and gay community that has been particularly in the news in the last few months over a new Russian law that makes it illegal to propagate to put forward any type of what they view as pro-gay propaganda, and concerns that even, say, in the Olympics next year, this could be a problem for some of the athletes there, depending on how that law is going to be enforced.
Well, with all the talk over Syria, do you see Syria as a symptom of a problem with U.S.-Russian relations, or is it a cause of a breakdown in relations?
Well, I'd say it's part of the cause. It's one of the major impediments in that relationship. There are some areas where there is a fair amount of agreement between the U.S. and Russia. I think the countries have been working together fairly well on some international arms control issues, on issues like North Korea and Iran, for example. The U.S. and Russia have been seeing eye to eye. But this Syria thing has been really a major, major obstacle in the relationship. It's not just that the U.S. and Russia don't have the same view on what should happen, but in fact, the U.S. position is that Syria is basically fueling the violence there, that is really providing a financial and a military lifeline for the Assad regime, and that the Russia is essentially complicit in everything that's been taking place in Syria over the last couple of years.
And President Putin has been supportive of Syria, and that's kind of their foothold, isn't it, in the Middle East? That's why it's such a big deal for Russia.
Yeah, a lot of people refer to Syria as a client state of Russia. You know, it's clearly an independent country, but there's just a long historical relationship and tie between the two countries. And it's interesting because the Russians and Putin often try to portray this as sort of a bulwark against Islamic extremism, that, you know, if they give in here and give in to the opposition, there's going to be some kind of an implosion, and that at the end of the day, the extremists are going to end up in control, much as they did in Afghanistan, for example, after the Soviet invasion there went sour and the Soviets pulled out. And so that's the way Putin tries to turn the argument around on the U.S.
You mentioned President Obama meeting with leaders from, I think it was China, Japan, and Germany. Are these trade talks, or is this again going to be trying to wrangle for either support or at least non-opposition to military action in Syria?
I think it's a little of both. You know, there's a little bit of talking about the economy and the full range of issues between the two countries. You know, even those countries, not totally, supportive. I think the French, for example, are supportive of the U.S. position on this. But among other countries, even Germany has said they don't plan to take part in any military action. The Japanese, I think, have said that they support some kind of an international response, but won't say more than that. And I doubt, given their history, that they would be at the forefront of pressing for a military response. And then China's position on the substance here has been basically the same as Russia. And what's so interesting about that is that the U.S. is really beating up the Russians over this, calling them, basically accusing them of holding the United Nations hostage over this issue. China has taken the same substantive position at the U.N. and has done it basically without public complaint from the United States.
And then another country there, British Prime Minister David Cameron was supportive of military action, but his parliament said, no, thanks. Is that going to make things awkward between the president and the prime minister?
Yeah, I don't know if they're going to have a formal meeting or just informal discussions. I don't think it would make it awkward between the two leaders, because the president and the prime minister's position there are the same. But there's no question that just seeing the two men together, it would be a reminder that there's at least a possibility the same thing could happen in the U.S. with President Obama's decision to try to seek a congressional endorsement and ratification of a military strike on Syria, it really being up in the air about whether that will happen, whether Congress will endorse what Obama wants to do or vote against it. And, certainly having Cameron in nearby would make a lot of people at least be reminded of the fact that the same move in Britain didn't go so well for Mr. Cameron.
Now you're covering the White House at home and abroad. President Obama trying to get support from somewhere. At the same time as this is going on, there's wrangling to get Congress to back military action in Syria. Do you think one looms larger for President Obama, international or domestic support?
I think at the moment the domestic fight is probably the bigger fight. I mean, the president can go forward without much more international support than he has right now. I think if you were to have a voting down of a resolution, the defeat of a resolution in Congress to authorize this kind of a mission, I frankly don't think the president would do it. It would be a huge embarrassment and a huge snub to him that I think would probably have some ramifications and repercussions that go well beyond this current Syria crisis. So I do think that's probably job one at the White House right now, but the schedule and the vagaries of, you know, trying to put these things on calendars weeks or months in advance has the president, you know, out of the country doing this diplomatic work right now, making it hard for him to be really burning up the phone lines or having meetings with members of Congress on this issue, though the White House says he has been speaking to members of Congress from his trip to St. Petersburg.
Josh, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Anytime. Thank you.
That was Josh Gerstein, senior White House reporter at Politico.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then we'll continue our Wisconsin Legend series with singer Tom Wopat of Dukes of Hazzard fame. This is Central Time.
It's time to talk about another Wisconsin legend, Tom Wopat. You might remember him from his days as Luke on the Dukes of Hazzard, but since then he's gone on to have an active recording and stage career.
His birthday is next week, so we thought we'd talk to the Wisconsin native about his new album and the latest news from his singing career. His new album is called I've Got Your Number. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, just fine.
I got to say, I grew up watching the Dukes of Hazzard. I never thought I'd actually get to talk to you.
I can't be held responsible for that.
You don't, seriously, you don't regret those days, do you?
Oh, no, I had a blast. We had a great time, and I ended up directing a half a dozen of them, so I got a little more out of it than just the huge acting skills that we worked on.
Do you ever still give a yee-haw every now and then?
Not much. Schneider now and then. I talked to him yesterday. So, you know, that stuff is all alive and well. The Dukes of Hazzard reunions are a big deal around the country, especially in the South and the Southeast. So I've been doing some of that in the last couple of years.
Nice. Well, you are from Wisconsin, like we just talked about as we introduced you, and you're from Lodi. So where do you live right now? Where are we calling you?
Well, I'm actually in North Jersey right now. I have a little log cabin out here, but I spend most of my time on the Upper West Side in Manhattan.
And you get back to Wisconsin from time to time to perform. I know I've seen your name around on various performing arts bills, right?
Yeah, I try to get there as much as I can, and I've maintained a relationship with Lecrone there at the UW, so I try and do some stuff with him every now and then as well.
And you've got a new album out. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It's called I've Got Your Number. And it's kind of a nod to the Mad Men era, the Rat Pack era of the 60s and 70s. And it the instrumentation is a nice little string section and then a pretty big horn section. So it's kind of a big band / orchestra arrangement sort of thing, and we did about half American songbook tunes, and then we also took songs from people like Paul Simon, Bruce Hornsby, Bruce Springsteen, Judy Collins. I wrote a couple of songs, and we give them kind of a big band treatment as well.
Well, let's let people hear what you're talking about. Here we go.
I won't dance, don't ask me. I won't dance, don't ask me. I won't dance, madam, with you. My heart won't let my feet do things they should do.
And that track called I Won't Dance from your new album called I've Got Your Number. And you know, tell us about, for people who've only maybe been familiar with your career as an actor, tell us about the singing side of it. How did that get started?
Well, I've been singing since I was a little kid, and I had great teachers at Lodi ever since I was in elementary school. They kind of took care of me and took me under their wing. And so I studied voice at the University of Wisconsin, so I've been a singer kind of forever.
Oh, it's interesting. I went there to study voice too. Interesting. So how did you get...
What year? You were there after I was, I was there. I started in 1969.
Yeah, that's after me, but I'm not going to say what year because I don't want people calculating my age. But who did you study with back then?
I studied with Dale Gilbert.
Okay.
Who actually ended up being head of the music school for a number of years. A really terrific guy. He actually, I think he was in school with Cheryl Milnes, who's a renowned baritone, bass baritone from the Chicago Lyric Opera.
Nice. Well, you've had kind of a dream career. You've gotten to do some of everything. You were on a hit TV show. You've been on Broadway. You've gotten to release albums in different genres. How did you get there from UW-Madison? If you want to give advice to people who are trying to do the same thing.
Can't keep a job, you know? I keep pushing at it, you know? It's one of those things where, I mean, actually, you know, right now I've got a little bit of vocal trauma. I've been dealing with not an infection, but an inflammation of the vocal cords. So it's kind of put me off my game a little bit. But mostly, I mean, I work pretty constantly. And I don't know. I stick at it. Fortunately for me, I've had different opportunities in the different parts of the business, and I've been able to take advantage of them. And I've had good people working with me. I've always had great musicians around me and really good fine producers. And I've been fortunate to have really good representation as far as agents and managers go as well.
Well, you're living in Manhattan now. You said you spend a lot of your time in Manhattan. You perform a lot in New York. What do people say when you tell them you're from Wisconsin?
They don't care.
They don't care. Come on, I want some reaction. At least they know about cheese and beer, right?
Yeah, you know, Packers, too. Pretty good subject. Actually, there's a bar near there where I go to watch Brewers games and Packers and Badgers. They play. There's a bar on the Upper West Side. And you run into a lot of people, actually. The Wisconsin sports fans are rabid, and they're everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you never really go too long without seeing them, and Manhattan is no exception. It's, you know, they've been very nice to me in New York, but I still have really strong connections to Wisconsin. I own my father's farm up in Lodi still, and my stepmom lives in Lodi, and I have a brother in Lodi and a brother in Milwaukee.
Oh, okay.
So I get home as much as I can. I was actually there last week to see the Brewers play and lose another one.
Yeah, it might not be the best season for that, but yeah.
They've had a tough year.
They had
a tough year, but I think it's a character-building year. I think they're going to be great next year. They've brought up a lot of really fine young players, and I think they're gonna have a real transitional year next year.
Yeah, I know a lot of people are hoping that you are right about that, and
are
feeling
the
same way.
Well, the Badgers this year are going to be awesome. Packers too. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
And the Bucks are starting over. I think they've made a nice adjustment in their situation and geared toward a younger team. I think they're going to be better. I mean, you know, I don't mean to dwell on sports, but it's one of my passions.
Yeah, I can tell you're from Wisconsin.
Yeah, well, I'm very fond of my Wisconsin sports teams,
yeah.
And I'm proud of them, too.
Well, that's good to hear, even
a
good old boy like you, still keeping the Wisconsin roots alive. Now, this album, to get back to your album, we could keep talking sports, but I do want to talk about your career. You're singing kind of jazz style on this, and
I've been doing this now for about 15 years. When I did Annie Get Your Gun, I started in 98 working with Bernadette, and when we made the Cast album in 99, the people at Angel Records asked me if I wanted to make a jazz record, and I had done country before. I'd never done jazz, and we did kind of a country pop, country rock kind of thing, but the jazz was just a nice fit, and the more that I've worked on it, the more that it fits my voice, and it's just something that seems to come naturally to me, and I very much enjoy it. And also, what we do, too, is, like, there are performers out there like Diana Krall and say, Diane Reeves, who take, and on their jazz records, they mix in a lot of contemporary and rock and roll stuff that they give a jazz treatment, and that's really what we've tried to do as well.
Well, let's listen to another little bit. This is the title track called I've Got Your Number.
I've got your number. number. I know you inside out. You ain't no Eagle Scout, you're all at sea. Oh yes, you brag a lot, wave your own.
And can you tell us a little bit about that particular track as a title track?
Yeah, well, that's a song that was written by Cy Coleman and Carolyn Lee. And Cy was actually a friend. I knew Cy. I met him back in 1978 when I first came to New York. And I did a musical of his called I Love My Wife, which the title track is a really nice record. And Sinatra recorded a version of I Love My Wife, the song. But I worked with Cy on several different musicals. There was one when I came back after Dukes. I did a musical called The City of Angels. And I remember one day in particular that I sat down with him and a couple of other actors, and he showed us basically how to sing swing. And it was the coolest thing ever. So this is a song that I think really reflects the era, the early 60s. And yeah, also, you know, I mean, between he and Carolyn Lee, there was a certain, I don't know, frisson, a certain tension.
All right, and we're going to have to leave it to listeners to listen to the album and get the rest of the story. We're out of time, but Tom, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a treat to talk to you.
All right, my pleasure. Anytime.
All right, that was Tom Wopat, Broadway singer and star of the 1970s TV show The Dukes of Hazzard.
If you have a suggestion for a future Wisconsin Legend segment, post it on the Central Time Facebook page or leave us a message toll-free 855-683-5422.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll take a look at the invention of the bleep. You know, that's a noise we have to play when someone swears, says something they shouldn't on the radio, and what the bleep says about modern censorship in America.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll find out why typewriters are still in use at some businesses across the country and why some business owners say they couldn't live without them.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.